Welcome to the UK and World News Channel on Orpio, powered by Audioboom. In this show, Wembley hosts France in a friendly match against the England team. The world watches on with solidarity. LBC speak to a woman whose husband was kidnapped by the Taliban, but she speaks beautifully in praise of refugees. And Charlie Sheen has confirmed that he is HIV positive. We listen back to some of the interview on NBC. First, the latest global headlines from the AP newsroom.
AP Radio News. I'm Rita Foley. Jordan's King Abdullah calls it a third world war against humanity, and he's calling for a coordinated worldwide response to the threat from the Islamic State group. The Islamic State is linked to Friday's terror attacks in Paris and to the destruction of a Russian passenger plane, which Moscow now says was brought down by a bomb. Our Lynn Berry is in Moscow, where President Vladimir Putin has a warning for whoever put the explosives on that airplane.
Russia would track down those responsible. He said, we're going to look for them everywhere, wherever they are hiding. We will find them in any place on earth and punish them.
In fact, we're told that Russia struck militant positions in Syria today with cruise missiles and bombs. And after Friday's attacks in Paris, the French are demanding that European countries step up the fight, too. Our Lauren Cook is in Brussels, the heart of the EU.
France has come to a meeting of European Union defense ministers asking for support, for aid and assistance. And in this case, it's looking particularly for EU members to help out with its operations in Syria or Iraq, or lifting the load, easing the load on some of the other operations that France is involved in.
The French President François Hollande will meet with President Obama and Russia's Vladimir Putin later this month. A community college along Florida's Space Coast is locked down after some sort of a threat, reportedly. Eastern Florida State College posted an alert on its Twitter account and on its website saying someone had threatened gun violence at the Cocoa, Florida campus. The warning urges students to stay inside. Snow is delaying some flights in Denver. Some roadways in the Denver area have been closed, too, because of the heavy snow. And in Baltimore, four people have been taken off of an airplane after somebody reported suspicious behavior. The Dow is up 89 points. This is AP Radio News. House Speaker Paul Ryan is calling for a pause in Syrian refugees coming to the U.S. in the wake of the Paris attacks, and said the House will vote on the issue this week.
Our nation has always been welcoming, but we cannot let terrorists take advantage of our compassion. This is a moment where it's better to be safe than to be sorry.
The House may vote on this as early as Thursday. If you are traveling for the Thanksgiving holiday, you're going to have plenty of company. A stronger economy and lower gas prices mean Thanksgiving travelers can expect more congested highways this year. During the long holiday weekend, 46.9 million Americans are expected to go 50 miles or more from home. That is the highest number since 2007. According to the AAA, that would be a 0.6% increase over last year and the 7th straight year of growth. I'm Rita Foley, AP Radio News.
First, French captain Hugo Lloris says the friendly match at Wembley with England will be an opportunity to show character after the events in Paris.
The last 3 days were a bit dramatic, and I think we were in the morning all together, and we spent time in Clairefontaine all together, and I think our president had the best decision to play this this game, and it would be an opportunity for us to show character and through that game. And we will share this moment with all the English people.
This is the call that touched LBC listeners. It's a woman who saw her husband kidnapped in Afghanistan. She spoke of the support she received from refugees from the Middle East.
2006, my husband, who works as a journalist from Italy, he was taken hostage in Afghanistan. And when he was taken hostage in Afghanistan, I happened to teach. And it was just the most amazing experience, because all the refugees were actually uniting, and they were so welcoming, and they used to pray for me, and I used to sometimes break down in tears in front of them because I couldn't stand the pressure when the foreign ministry would call in and give me some updates. So every time they would call in, I used to break down in front of the class, and they would come up and hug and pray for me in the break. And it was, those people had gone through the worst trauma possibly imaginable, and they were actually praying for me, for someone who was actually, you know, much better off and who hadn't gone through any trauma. But
off in some ways, but with a husband being held hostage by, was it the Taliban?
Well, it's a long story.
Of course,
I mean, it's still not clear who actually took him hostage. He came back alive after 23 days, so he was released, and we had a daughter afterwards, you know, another child.
Yes.
So it was a happy ending. I hope, I just wish I could, you know, extend the love. I've just read a story on Facebook where this man just posted a really emotional story about his wife who got killed.
Yes, I've seen that as well. His wife is yes.
Yes, I just hope I could have said the same thing if he hadn't come back alive, you know.
Well, here's the thing. And who knows, and thank God you never had to find out how you would have coped if he'd been killed. But here's the thing, there's plenty of people in this country, it's a little bit tempting sometimes to malign them all as knuckle-dragging racists, but they're not. Plenty of people in this country have genuine concerns that we might be letting into our communities people who want to do things like the events we saw in Paris. You, as someone whose husband has been held hostage by, we have to presume, fundamentalists, you say to them, how do you stop them being frightened, Sylvie?
Well, you can't live your life being frightened. I mean, we have particularly chosen to live in London because it's multicultural. We could live in a seaside town where he's from. I could live in the mountains in Austria and feel safe, you know, shielded from the so-called, you know, multiculturalism, which would expose me to potential threats. I chose to live here because that's what I welcome about humanity, being able to live together as one, being able to be welcoming. You will always have the one odd, you know, dark soul who will try to destroy humanity as such. But if we let that happen, we as humans have just failed.
We as humans will have failed if we allow the possibility of one terrorist sneaking into the country to empower us to turn away all of the refugees.
Exactly. I mean, if I go to my daughter's school where 50 languages are spoken, I feel so blessed to be able to actually do that. I just have friends from all over the world, and that's what makes us human. We are different. We have to be welcoming. We have to be able to live as one. We have to stay united. We can't let hatred win over, because as soon as you let hatred, you know, take over, that's it.
There are some very loud voices in this country who appear to be seeking that hatred, not on a level of carnage and death, but certainly on a level of division and rejection. We're going to struggle to shout them down, I think, Sylvie.
I feel so saddened by this. You know, when I hear Farage and the likes of him talking, I just feel like this is not what I stand for, and I will never ever accept that as any of, you know. And I will try to reason with the people who will, you know, shout the loudest, but some people are just so narrow-minded. You can't argue with some people, but you can just continue smiling. When I see a lady next door working down in her back, I just smile at her because it makes her feel more comfortable. I see the fear in her eyes when she looks at me because she's frightened herself that I will look upon her in a bad way. And she smiles back because she's probably just relieved, you know, to see me actually smiling at her. And that's what should actually happen. We should respond with a smile, respond just with nice gestures, just being genuinely human, you know. That's what makes us different from these animals.
Charlie Sheen has revealed in an interview with NBC that he is HIV positive and has been blackmailed as he tried to keep that a secret. On In Case You Missed It by 96.3 FM WDVD, they look back at the interview.
Charlie Sheen on the Today Show this morning telling the world that he is HIV positive, sitting down with Matt Lauer and discussing his behavior and all sorts of different things over the past few years. Here's a little bit of the interview.
Have you knowingly, or even perhaps unknowingly, transmitted the HIV virus to someone else since your diagnosis?
Impossible. impossible.
We're going to talk to your doctor with you in a second about that.
I look forward to it. Good.
Have you had unprotected sex on any occasion since your diagnosis?
Yes, but the two people that I did that with were under the care of my doctor, and they were completely warned ahead of time.
Have you, since the time of your diagnosis, told every one of your sexual partners, before you had a sexual encounter, that you were HIV positive?
Yes, I have.
No exception?
No exception.
Have you been involved, you know, if you look at the CDC website and they talk about the transmission of HIV, they talk about risky behaviors. Would it be fair to say that you have been involved in all of those risky behaviors?
Negative. No, you're talking about needles and that whole mess? No, definitely not.
Do you know how you contracted the virus?
Sitting here today, not entirely. No.
I want to read you something else from the letter you handed me. You said, this is after the time of your diagnosis. The personal disbelief, karmic confusion, shame, and anger led to a temporary yet abysmal descent into profound substance abuse and fathomless drinking. Was this that whole tiger blood winning period in your life? Was that a result, that meltdown we saw, a reaction to your diagnosis?
I wish I could blame it on that. That was more of a roid rage. But this was on the heels of that, let me say, yeah.
And when you say shame in that, the stigma that is attached to this diagnosis is one of the worst parts about it. People don't take action, they don't get help because of that stigma.
Sure.
Do you still feel that stigma?
Not anymore, I don't. I have a responsibility now to better myself and to help a lot of other people. And hopefully with what we're doing today, others may come forward and say, thanks, Charlie, thanks for kicking the door open.
You know, I hope that what happens is maybe people who have been living in a similar sort of lifestyle are looking at Charlie Sheen going, whoa. There but for the grace of God go I.
Yeah, I was talking about this last night with a friend, and I hope that he can, you know, he is a celebrity, whatever you want to say about him,
right.
And he does have a lot of eyes on him, and sometimes something like this can be turned into a positive in the way that he can now educate, and he can now talk to people who are living similar lifestyles or who even aren't.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, whether you like it or not, we listen to what celebrities have to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
All eyes were on him when he was destructive and going through that publicly. And now maybe all eyes could be on him for a positive reason.
Yeah.
It's really scary to think that he has to resort to going on the Today Show because of, you know, there was talk about extortion.
Mm-hmm.
And there was talk about people revealing this secret. And maybe that was kind of a preventative measure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's just really too bad that somebody of his stature and has had all the opportunity in life. It's in his family.
Yeah.
You know, it has to go in that direction.
Yeah. Well, he had said to Matt Lauer, we didn't play it, but he said he's already had to give money, he said, adding up to the millions for people who wanted to come out with this secret. And, you know, why couldn't he fight this battle privately with his family?
Right, yeah. And the extortion thing, it's the whole thing, there's nothing but a big cloud of negativity around it. And like you said, I mean, hopefully this is a turning point for him personally.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully for people who are living lives that are similar to the way he lived, maybe this will kind of wake them up a little bit.
And discussing the latest news, here is the Pacey The Briefing from London's Midori House and Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 17th of November 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up in today's programme, police raid homes in France and Belgium as an international manhunt continues.
And I'm Tom Burgess Watson in Paris, and I'll have the latest on what the French Defence Minister said. France cannot do everything single-handedly. This is the nation calls on the European Union for aid and assistance.
We continue our coverage on the deadly Paris attacks on today's show. And we follow the money, looking at who's funding the Islamic State and the barriers the global financial community needs to tackle. Then later in the programme, we'll look at Australia's first Muslim political party. And we'll also discuss Volkswagen's stalled sales. All that and more besides ahead on The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. A busy show in prospect in the next 30 minutes. First, though, Friday's attacks in Paris have made headlines around the world. Joining us here in Studio One to look at how some papers in various corners are covering the story is Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Faye, thanks for being on the programme. Where should we start? I know you have a few of today's front pages out of France with you.
Exactly. Well, let's start with Le Monde, which I think has the most remarkable front page today. Mm. It's quite a picture that takes more than half of the front page. Of a soldier walking underneath the Eiffel Tower, and on top says La France en état d'urgence, you know, France in a state of emergency. And it's quite an impressive coverage, of course, as you would presume from one of the main dailies in France. The first 36 pages are all about, you know, the aftermath of the Paris attacks, and there's quite a lot of interesting stories. Difficult to pick one. Of course, they do something that we covered actually on our morning show today, The Globalist, about that neighborhood of Molenbeek in Belgium, which apparently
lots of focus in the international news media, understandably, on that neighborhood.
Exactly. And also we have, of course, Libération, which again, of course, has just l'état d'urgence permanent, like the permanent emergency in France. And there's a picture of François Hollande giving his speech yesterday, quite a fiery speech.
Yeah, and the whole front page is that picture of Hollande standing before the meeting of both houses of parliament, you know, as you say, permanent state of emergency.
And Libération is a bit like the Independent here in England. They always choose like a striking picture. Mm. They don't have so much text on their front pages as well.
Fernando, what about this sort of international? Because we've been talking a little bit about how the international news media has been covering it. And one of the images, I guess, that crops up and it draws people's attention is the tricolour, whether it's, as you said, on the front pages of newspapers or whether it's monuments that are lit up in those colours. We've seen Wembley Stadium here in London.
Exactly.
Lit up that way ahead of the friendly football match tonight. And the New York Times has... Well, perhaps yesterday's most iconic image, I suppose.
Yeah, of course, the Eiffel Tower in a tricolour image, very impressive. And of course, down there have other pictures of people mourning, the people gathering the streets of Paris. You know, a tribute to the people who were killed at the attacks. And they also have quite an interesting piece here saying that, you know, after Charlie Hebdo, there were a lot of movement in Paris to say, you know, not all Muslims did that. You know, they were trying to protect the community. But I think this time, the French are much cooler in that sense. Mm. So there hasn't been march, you know, to say that, you know, not all Muslims support that, you know what I mean? So we see this might be good for Marine Le Pen. And again, there's another article for, talking about that as
well. Well, we've already seen her, you know, trying to make political capital. I suppose that was inevitable that she and other people on the sort of right of the political spectrum could try and do that. Let's continue our international sweep, Fernando. Now, we're used to you looking at the papers from your hometown, of course. What do they make of it? What's the tone of the coverage there?
Well, what I think is interesting about Folha de São Paulo, you know, there's been a lot of cutbacks in newspapers recently. And so Folha, they didn't have a Paris correspondent. They just had a London one. But actually reading the issue, I think they realized how big a story is that. Mm. So they actually send their London correspondent to Paris. And they actually send other two reporters from Brazil as well. So that shows how important it is to have someone on the ground. So, for example, Vinicius Torres Freire, he's one reporter usually based in Brazil. He was just kind of talking about how it was to be in Paris after the attacks. Mm. You know, they said life was almost back to normal. They said there was still a sense of fear, and he was talking to some Brazilians in the city. You know, even the consulate of France in Brazil said, because a lot of people are canceling their trips to Paris, but they say, please go, you know, we have to support the city in a way, otherwise we would be defeated by the terrorists.
Well, it's very much the kind of house view, I guess, here in Monocle about, you know, you need to keep making your investments, you need to keep visiting, you know, whether it's hotels, businesses, to keep the city afloat. That's one of the ways everyone can respond positively. It's amazing, though, to me that a lot of newspapers, as you rightly point out, owing to the times we're in, you know, don't have a Paris correspondent.
It seems
such it would always be such a fixture. It's amazing, really.
Exactly. So I think it's interesting, you know, as you can see, when there is a big story, they not send not only one, but actually three.
Exactly. So, a measure of the scale of the story and a sense of the way the newspapers are covering it, provided by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Faye, thanks for joining us here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. 5 minutes past the hour. Now, for a second night, French airstrikes focused on the Syrian city of Raqqa, a hub for the Islamic State militants. French officials have made a formal call for EU military help, invoking a mutual assistance article in the EU's treaty for the first time. Overnight, more than 120 terror raids were made by French police, and the manhunt continues for the eighth suspect in Friday's attacks. Well, let's get the latest from Paris. Monocle's correspondent in the French capital, Tom Burgess-Watson, is on the line now. Tom, what more do we know about the state of the investigation? Are people there talking about progress that's been made, or is it really still the overwhelming scale of the endeavour that's front and centre?
Well, I think there's action on two fronts, really, and that's really what's grabbing the attention of the media. As you said there, the international action, namely the airstrikes, which have been stepped up across Syria, northern Syria, and that Islamic State stronghold of Raqqa. And then here on in France, there have been dozens more raids on suspected extremists across the country during the night. The Interior Ministry says they're monitoring 10,500 different individuals now, and a series of arrests have been made. And during these raids, presumably they're finding more clues. They've seized computers, they've seized weapons, they've found a safe house, a rocket launcher in one case. So clearly a massive investigation happening here in France, accompanying those raids, and each raid presumably yielding more clues. And that's just on the French side of the border. And of course, in Belgium too, the manhunt continues for one of the prime suspects, Saleh Abdesalem, who is thought to be there in Belgium. He's a Belgian national.
Tom, just on that point, I mean, people talked a little bit about intelligence failures in the build-up to the attacks. They've talked about, I don't know, holes in the sort of the rings of steel around the cities and indeed around the countries as these people maybe made their way out of Paris. Saleh Abdeslam potentially one of those. How tough are the questions being asked of the security services, of the police, about what some are perceiving as potential failures?
Well, I think people accept that the intelligence services are stretched very thinly when they're now monitoring 10,500 individuals. I mean, monitoring one individual on a 24/7 basis requires at least a headcount of three and a huge cost as well. So I think, you know, people accept, and it's been announced by the authorities here, that there have been numerous intelligence successes for each intelligence failure, if we were going to call it that. And, you know, the tactics of these extremists are constantly changing. Their means of communicating with one another are constantly changing, and they come from a very sophisticated network, which is still quite new in the experience of the intelligence services. So I think there is a degree of public understanding. I have heard very little, even at this early stage, it's just been 3 days, but I've heard very little by way of criticism of the French authorities and the French security services.
Tom, let me ask you, Fernando was mentioning there the front page of Libération this morning, talking about, you know, this permanent state of emergency. There'll be a vote, as I gather, tomorrow, whether to extend this state of emergency for as much as 3 months. You've also got one French minister proposing, you know, metal detectors at all railway stations in the country. How are these potential measures being, I don't know, welcomed or discussed by the people that you're talking to?
Well, I think it's very important that the government is perceived as taking swift action and concrete action. The president yesterday gave a very rare address to a joint session of the upper and lower houses at Versailles, and that's the second time in history that's ever happened. So that was already deemed as being very symbolic, but as well as the symbolism, people wanted to hear words, you know, of action coming from the mouth of the president. And he did say that he wanted to see the state of emergency extended from the current 12 days to 3 months. As you say, that's going to be voted on tomorrow. He expressed the will of the government to increase funding for the police and their equipment. He outlined a whole series of measures. It was a very long speech, in fact, more than 40 minutes he spoke for, talking about revoking the citizenship of any convicted terrorists who've got dual nationality. He also expressed his desire to meet President Barack Obama and President Putin. That's apparently going to happen next week now, on the basis of that request just voiced just yesterday afternoon, and we understand that Hollande is going to go to Moscow and Washington to meet those two leaders. Very interesting that he's meeting not just France's oldest ally, namely the United States, but Vladimir Putin, the president of a country which, of course, France has had, like many other Western countries, some rather thorny relations with. So lots of talk of action and things like metal detectors, things like troops on the streets. There are already 115,000 security personnel mobilized right across the country. I just think people want to see and hear that there is something happening and that the government is taking this extremely seriously.
Tom, just a corollary to that point about sort of the diplomacy angle. It's interesting that we haven't heard much about France talking to NATO or calling on NATO for help, but they're invoking this clause asking the European Union more broadly for military assistance. Was that always a predictable turn of events, do you think?
No, I think, none of this has been predictable, really. I mean, and the fact that France has got, as I said, 115,000 security personnel mobilized across the country just goes to show how overstretched the French military is. This is an age in which European armies are downsizing, budgets are being cut. And at the same time, France has got troops in Mali, in the Central African Republic, in Chad, in the United Arab Emirates, not just as part of a peacekeeping mission, but in most cases, by way of their own sovereign forces. And so we had the French defense minister Jean-Yves Le Drian telling European defense ministers in Brussels that France can't do everything single-handedly, and therefore this request was put to them formally, repeating really what the president said yesterday in Versailles, that the EU must help because of this clause on mutual assistance. And from what we understand from Federica Mogherini, the foreign policy chief, that request has been fully accepted, unilaterally accepted. So we don't yet know exactly what form that assistance is going to take, but the request has been made, it's been accepted. So France can count on its European allies and friends and partners to tackle this together with France.
Monocle's Paris correspondent Tom Burgess Watson bringing us up to speed from the French capital. Thanks very much for joining us here on The Briefing. It's exactly 13 minutes past the hour, 7:13 in Washington, D.C. It's been suspected for a number of weeks, but now Moscow has confirmed that an act of terror brought down a Russian plane over Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. Coordinated terror attacks like that and those in Paris that we've just been discussing are not only well planned, but also well paid for. So after years of conferences, task forces and UN Security Council resolutions, why are global terror finance efforts still failing? Well, joining us on the line is Tom Keating, Director of the Centre for Financial Crime and Security Studies at RUSI. Tom, thanks for being on the programme. It is interesting. Presumably all of these kinds of endeavours are expensive. Are we any closer to understanding what IS is? I don't know how you'd describe it. Operating budget, what it is, what it looks like?
So, as it relates to IS in Syria and Iraq, I mean, there is reasonably good analysis of the amount of money that they operate with, so be it the weekly earnings from oil, be it looking at what the Iraqi government used to pay in its national budget for the provinces that are still controlled by Islamic State now. That was $2 billion a couple of years ago. So they operate a major budget. They operate like a state in that regard, taxing people, earning money from the trade of oil, which is well documented. The question, of course, is whether they can continue to raise the amount of money they need to deliver on the promises they make to the local people.
Well, give us a sense then, Tom, of the intricacies of these financial operations. You talk about much of it being oil-based, these sort of tax and spend systems they have in some areas of territory they control. What do we know about the broader financial setup? How advanced is, the bookkeeping almost? How would the debit and credit ledger work when it comes to financing acts of terrorism like we've seen in these other geographical areas?
So as it relates to the finances of Islamic State in its state, they operate a model that, frankly, any country would be proud of in terms of the way that finance is accounted for. Every now and again, when there's a special forces raid on a house of a financier, it's always striking just how much detail and how much bookkeeping goes into running Islamic State. When you think about attacks such as those in Paris, the question always to ask is that funding that was raised by the individuals who mounted the attack themselves, or is that funding which was provided by a central organization, whether it was Al-Qaeda or Islamic State, as might be suspected in this case. So understanding how these missions are financed is an important part of the post-attack analysis that the security authorities do, because it reveals all sorts of connections that perhaps aren't otherwise visible.
Tom, people have talked a lot about how hard it is to monitor, you know, chatter correspondence, particularly when it's, of course, digital. What about following the money? You know, so often in kind of criminal type investigations, that's the mantra: follow the money. It explains everything. What are some of the key barriers for people who look at these areas, like yourself, your colleagues, and others who are focused, security services, for example? How complex is it to try and surmount those barriers, and how committed to leaving barriers in place are groups like IS and its affiliates?
So on the one hand, you know, following the money, cliche though it is relatively easy, particularly when an event has occurred. You know, the authorities can subpoena information from banks, they can piece together picture very quickly. Of course, that presupposes that terrorist organizations use the formal financial system, and over the years, they've learned that actually, if you want to get caught, use the formal system. Better to use the informal system, to use hawala networks, to use cash couriers. There was obviously a case last year where an individual was stopped traveling through Heathrow Airport with money en route to support Islamic State. So those informal ways of moving money around are clearly far more difficult for the authorities to identify and disrupt, and those are the cracks that terrorist organizations will, in the first instance, try and use.
Tom, do you think that there's more to be done? You mentioned sort of informal system, but what about that? I don't know, the kind of private sector? You know, clearly there's monitoring in place, and again, one assumes that the intelligence services from different countries have degrees of access to that information, as confused and as cloudy as it can sometimes be. Is there more to be done from the private sector too, do you think?
Most definitely there is. I mean, the authorities put the private sector, the banks, on the front line, and they are required to do the monitoring and to do the identifying on behalf of the security authorities, or at least to supplement the work that the security authorities do. What is lacking, and still lacking, is direction from the authorities to the private sector as to just precisely what to look for. You know, banks are good at spotting fraud and other forms of financial crime which hurt their bottom line. They're frankly not good, not trained at spotting the types of finance that might indicate terrorist activity. And so the sooner we empower the financial sector with that kind of education and training, the sooner we can get them to add to the counter-terrorism effort.
Tom, just finally, let me ask you, I mean, I know your research, it looks at sort of finance and security, but you also look at sort of financial warfare, I guess, for want of a better phrase. Is that helpful? Is that a semantic thing? Or is that really what we need, the way we need to look at this to address it? We need to consider the financial domain as almost a field of war. Is that something that's important for people to get their minds around?
Without question, particularly for groups like Islamic State or Al-Shabaab, or you know, these groups that really do require significant amounts of funding in order to operate, figuring out what their sources of finance are and then restricting, strangling those sources of finance is a very easy way of disrupting them. Of course, you know, that you're not going to change their ideology by doing that, but you at least restrict their ability to operate. So understanding financial flows is absolutely critical, and frankly something that I believe very strongly that we should be doing more of.
Tom, just very, very briefly then, who drives that shift in approach? Does that come from governments? Does it come from kind of supranational organisations? You know, where should the pressure be brought to bear to make people appreciate the point that you just made?
The problem we face is that generally speaking, security is conducted on a national basis. You know, the whether it's an MI5 in the UK or you know, the FBI or whatever, you know, they conduct this, generally speaking, on a national basis. The problem, of course, is that finance flows very quickly across borders. Terrorism is a transnational threat. And so until there is some kind of, as you put it, supranational effort to tackle terrorist finance and to really tackle it, not just give out directions and recommendations like the Financial Action Task Force, until that happens, we will always be one step behind because we will be in silos. The guys we want to stop will be operating seamlessly across borders.
Fascinating insights, Tom. Thanks for being with us. That's Tom Keating, Director of the Centre for Financial Crime and Security Studies at RUSI. This is The Briefing. Up next, we're talking about religion and politics and how they blend in Australia. Stay tuned.
The Monocle Minute is our daily email bulletin covering all the topics we're passionate about, from global affairs to retail news, finance to urbanism, architecture to transport. Packed with opinions and reports from around the globe, it's a unique briefing on the day from our editors and correspondents. Go to monocle.com to sign up for free today, and we'll send you the Monocle Minute to your inbox every weekday and deliver you a special weekend edition, which brings you the best in hospitality, retail, food and drink, and culture. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world every day of the week.
Here in London, Australia's political spectrum has a new element added to the mix. The first Islamic faith-based political party is hoping to have candidates in every riding for next year's federal elections. The group is called the Australian Muslim Party. One key policy is that it would never support military action in a Muslim country in response to terrorism. Well, joining us now from Canberra is political journalist and commentator Karen Middleton. Karen, good to speak with you again. Thanks for being on the show. I guess with events in Paris, as we've been discussing so far on the programme, it's rather hard to separate news of a group like this from those events. Is that an error to look at the launch of this party through that prism? Is it unhelpful?
No, in fact, they themselves have said they're seizing upon the attention from the Paris events to launch their party now. They've been talking about launching a party, and it's a group of people based in Western Sydney where there is a big Muslim population, but particularly Lebanese and a number of other elements of Muslim people of the Muslim faith. But they've got a bit of a hurdle to get over yet. They've got to register themselves, and to do that they need 500 signatures. So in a sense it's a bit of a PR campaign to try and generate the support to get themselves registered. We've got a bit of a history here in Australia of micro parties, some of which occasionally are religious based, and in fact the most successful of those is the Christian Democratic Party, which has had a representative in the New South Wales legislature at state level for some 30 years. But this is the first time, as you say, we've seen a Muslim party appear, and they say they're doing so in response to the anti-Islamic activism that's arisen. There are a number of small parties now that are saying they're anti-Islam that are also wanting to register. So they say they're aiming to register in response to them.
So, Karen, give us a sense of, you know, when people look from Australia to, for example, you know, the Middle East or events as we've seen in Europe over the past few days, this idea of how much domestic political politics is shaped by, you know, events overseas, foreign policy incursions involving, you know, whether it's the Australians or, you know, other Western allies. Do people understand that, these things are always viewed through that prism, if you like? You know, you can't isolate the feelings and antagonisms domestically from big foreign policy questions such as, you know, Western engagement in whether it's Iraq or Syria or in other countries. Is that complexity reflected in the discourse, I guess, when it comes to these issues within Australia?
I don't know if it's reflected. I mean, it's not reflected in its full complicated glory. It is reflected in a more populist sense. We've seen over the last two decades the issue of immigration in this country become extremely sensitive. It's a hot button issue and has been dating back to before the attacks on the United States in 2001. But there has been a confluence of domestic politics with events like that, and again here in Paris. And political parties, particularly the conservative political parties here in Australia, have had a tendency towards populism, seizing upon these kinds of events to push home some very hardline policies against asylum seekers in particular. It was a successful tactic employed by then Prime Minister John Howard back in 2001 after those original terrorist attacks, American terrorist attacks. And there are all sorts of, pardon me, people sort of pleading for that not to be the case again now. But we've seen our former Prime Minister, and he's only recently former, Tony Abbott, join this debate in the last week since Paris. In fact, it's just before Paris, and again since, saying that Australia should take a greater role in Syria, and again that Europe has much to learn from our tough anti-asylum seeker policies in Australia. So he is engaging in the debate, and that is guaranteeing that the politics of global terrorism are seen through a domestic prism here.
Journalist and commentator Karen Middleton in Canberra, thanks very much for joining us here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. Minutes past the hour. Let's wrap up today's show by looking to the world of business. Here to guide us through some of the big business stories of the day, we're joined by Axel Threlfall, for Reuters editor at large. Axel, great to speak with you as always. There's a story we've been charting over a good few weeks, really, which is Volkswagen, of course, and its various travails. What do the sales figures tell us about where VW is right now?
Pretty much as expected, Tom, European sales and the market shares down in October. This is October we're talking about, the real hit. Apparently it's going to come, or at least will be seen first this month, the November numbers. But their European sales and the market share is down despite the overall car market in Europe growing. So clearly the emissions cheating scandal is taking its toll. I say Europe is growing. New car registrations in the EU up about or just under 3% in October. 26th consecutive month of growth. Remember, Europe had been slowing down for a long, long time. So the context is good. What's happening to VW isn't off 0.8% with its share of the European market also slipping. Very interesting, though. The mass market brands were hit, the Skodas and the Seats, but the premium brands, the Audis and the Porsches, are actually still looking pretty good.
Axel, just briefly on the sort of boardroom machinations of this, how does the market look at Volkswagen now? Because we talked about how maybe there was an over-exaggerated correction, if you like, after all of this news broke. What do the markets make of this big corporate behemoth now?
You know, I think, you know, they look at it with awareness. We've got to wait and see what happens. I think the share price gyrations have settled down a little bit now, and probably will remain like that for a while. We've got to see what the company does. We've got to see how the overall numbers are affected. We've got to see just how widespread this issue is, not just in Volkswagen, but perhaps elsewhere in the industry. So I think for the time being things have settled, but don't expect that to be it, I think is probably the safest way to put it.
Axel, time is short. Let me just look to the skies, though, finally. EasyJet, so what are they saying about, I don't know, the demand for travel services?
Actually, as far as EasyJet's concerned, they've ordered 36 more planes to drive the expansion. They reported an 18% jump in annual profits today. Carolyn McCall, the CEO, said things look good despite, you know, these hits from the geopolitics, the attacks in Paris, the Russian plane crash over Egypt last month. You know, she said, and she made this point very clear, she said, you're going to have a temporary hit in sales, in revenues from individual seats, but that bounces back pretty quickly. And that's what they expected, EasyJet.
Thank you very much, Axel, for being with us on the programme. As always, that's Axel Threlfall, Reuters editor at large, guiding us through the business stories of the day here on The Briefing. And that is just about all we have time for on today's programme. The show was produced by Emily Elias and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jamie Waters. Thanks to our studio manager, Weidong Lin, for the next half hour. Stay tuned. Matt Alagaya is bringing you the very best from our international playlist through till 1300 London time. This show's back at the same time tomorrow noon here in London, of course, or you can catch up with past editions or any of our other great shows anytime. Do it at your convenience, monocle.com/radio. Check it all out there for you on our website. I'm Tom Edwards. From me and the team today, that's all we've got time for. Thanks very much for tuning in.
You've been listening to the UK and World News Channel on Orpio, powered by Audioboom.